Next up, Joseph Margulies and I discuss the complaint from a legal perspective and the case of Abu Zubaydah. We also discuss how and if U.S. government officials should be held accountable for torture and other crimes. You're listening to Veracity Radio. We're joined now by Joe Margulies, who is a clinical professor of law at the Northwestern University School of Law in Chicago, Illinois. How are you doing this morning? Or actually, we're now in the afternoon. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right. Afternoon. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Talking about this complaint form that was filed with the Texas Board of Examiners of Psychologists, how did you become involved in this particular complaint?
Well, I have been involved in post 9/11 detention litigation, detention issues since November of 2001.
Okay.
And was counsel in the first case that went to the Supreme Court from Guantanamo, which was Rasul versus Bush, and presently represent a guy who was in the enhanced interrogation program. In fact, he was the first person in the enhanced interrogation program and therefore was interrogated by Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen. And so it was through that work that I became familiar with their role, and this licensing challenge grew out of that knowledge.
The complaint had started with Jim, and then they, knowing that your experience in the field, contacted you for your opinion?
No, actually, it went the other way around.
Oh, the other way around.
We reached out to Jim.
Okay.
Because we believed that, well, it was more simultaneous, actually, I would say.
Okay.
There are, as you probably are aware, there are a number of psychologists around the country who feel that their profession has taken a black eye because of the role of psychologists in the enhanced interrogation program. And many of them feel, including the American Psychological Association, feel quite strongly that psychologists have no business doing that, and those that do it at risk of their license. And Jim, to his considerable credit, is one of the people who feels very strongly that way, that this is an affront to the profession, and that this is a matter of policing the integrity of his own world. And so agreed to collaborate with us on this effort.
Let's go ahead and go back a little bit and start with that Rasul versus Bush. Now, this was the case of Shafiq Rasul. Let's talk about the fact that in November 2001, who contacted you to come into this sphere? Or were you already practicing law related to this that made it fairly obvious?
Well, of course... no one was practicing law related to areas that we have all since become experts in. One thing that happened after 9/11, in particular after the Bush administration's reconception of how detention should take place, is that we all acquired knowledge very quickly. The United States had never before created a prison beyond the law, which is what Guantanamo was designed to be.
Right.
And the timing of November was when President Bush made the first announcement, November of 01, about the plan to hold military commissions rather than real trials. And the original thinking of the group that I was part of was that this would be, our challenge would be to military commissions. But we quickly realized, once prisoners start arriving at the base at Guantanamo, that they would never hold commissions, because if you can simply hold people without any process at all, why would you go through the potential embarrassment and expense of prosecuting them? And so we realized that the real problem was indefinite detention without legal process. And that's what Rasul was. It was a challenge to the phenomenon of indefinite detention, potentially permanent detention without legal process.
Going a hair before that, what had we already learned with the Rahman case, for instance? Because that was our first real public terrorism trial.
Well,
that became the first, if you will, a paradigm for terror trials.
Right. What is widely regarded as the most important shift between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration is the orientation to detention without legal process versus prosecution. And prior to the Bush administration, in fact, even in the early stages of the Bush administration, if you go back and look at the initial rhetoric, the expectation was that if these guys were captured, if anyone in connection with this was captured, they'd be prosecuted. They'd be brought to the United States and prosecuted just like we had always done. And it was a gradual shift that basically took place in the Bush administration's thinking and was gradually became more and more of the dominant narrative within the media throughout 2002, and it has waxed and waned, and now it is almost impossible to escape. It's very interesting how quickly narratives change, and right. What was understood as the sort of norm was terrorism is a crime. If we arrest someone who has committed a terrorist act, we will bring them here and prosecute them. We had a remarkable level of success. We were more successful at that kind of crime than just about any other prosecution that you could possibly imagine. I mean, we were universally successful. No one ever lost those cases. And now suddenly there's this conviction that it's a mistake to treat these cases as crimes, and we must do some sort of alternative detention program, and it's a terrible mistake.
Now, we're also aware that a lot of these decisions were backed up, in many cases, post by John Yoo and the OLC. Since the OLC, these guys work directly with them all the time. I assume when you're that insular, you know, you make decisions that someone who isn't in that system would make, but to protect your own. In your sense, in those early days, what was the legal community, their first reactions to this? Was this all founded as rather surprising?
Well,
or did it vary along the ACLU lines and then?
We now know a fair amount of how this all unfolded.
Right.
What's interesting to bear in mind is that when the torture discussion in the United States really began not long after 9/11, but what's really striking, October, November, December, when it really started getting underway in the United States.
Right.
But what was really striking at that time is how silent the Bush administration was. They, in fact, did not really join in this discussion. Nobody from the Bush administration came out and said, yeah, in fact, we are considering these options. Absolutely not. There was nothing like that. Mm-hmm. This was all just external commentators.
Right.
But what we now know, what we didn't know then, but what we now know, is that at that very moment, they were designing the enhanced interrogation program. James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen were proposing the enhanced interrogation program and proposing the various techniques that would be used, and they were refining that process in early 2002, and the first person they used it on was Abu Zubaydah after he was arrested in March of 2002. Nobody knew that. We didn't know that. The public didn't know any of this until the memos were leaked in 2004. And I would say that the reaction of the legal community when those memos appeared was one of horror. Not without exception. There were some people who thought that this was perfectly legitimate legal reasoning. But by and large, the memos were and continue to be roundly condemned by scholars as very shoddy analysis, very dubious analysis.
These first cases were all about the right to even be heard. To me, being someone who's into history, the creation of the Magna Carta and the habeas rights was to remove on a citizen level, to remove any doubt of the ability for someone to control a trial beyond evidence in a way, so that, you know, the king could just slap you into prison, or a baron or someone slap you in prison. You've got no right to say anything because they're absolute authority. This set us back to those pre-Magna Carta days. The argument in the public sphere was that we're granting rights to these individuals. And from my view, not being a lawyer, is that due process itself would require habeas, that due process shouldn't really count whether the defendant or even their representative even has a sense of the rights. Maybe they don't, but shouldn't we give them the rights anyway because of the due process nature that ultimately should end with the guilty seeing responsibility and the innocent being cleared? Am I way off base there?
Well, you don't. Yeah, no, you're not way off base at all, but okay. You don't want to merge two different things here.
Okay.
First of all, habeas is habeas corpus just means you have the body.
Right.
Latin for you have the body.
Right.
And it is a legal mechanism by which a court calls upon the executive, the jailer, to justify the lawfulness of the detention. It
Correct.
Says no person is beyond the law. You may have a right to hold him. I can't tell yet. But until you bring him to me and demonstrate the lawfulness of his detention, then it is presumptively unlawful. It is without law. It is simply by fiat of the crown. And that's what habeas was meant to overturn. Now, that's not the same necessarily as a criminal prosecution.
Okay.
And so there are some people who have a right to be prosecuted, and there are some, and you cannot hold them unless you prosecute them. And there are some people who do not have a right to demand that they be prosecuted in a regular court, but they do have a right to demand that there be some showing to prove the lawfulness of their detention. That is, let's say Congress passed a statute, this would be unlawful, but they say, we are going to, not unprecedented, but they've done it before, but one hopes they never would, we're going to lock up all citizens of Japanese descent. We're going to create a statute that says all those people are dangerous. Okay. And they come and they arrest you. And they say, your name is Hara, you're Japanese, come, you're going to be locked up. Well, you have a right to go into court and say, wait a second, you've just got the wrong person. You leave aside whether the statute is constitutional. I'm not Hara. I'm O'Hara. I'm Irish. I'm not Japanese. You just got the wrong guy.
Right.
You got to have some mechanism, some legitimate mechanism, by which you separate wheat from chaff, the people who are lawfully detained. And that's separate from prosecution.
Okay.
Rasul was about the latter. All we were saying was, and all we've ever said, and what the Supreme Court eventually agreed with us, both in Rasul and later in Boumediene, is if you don't create your own process, if you don't have a legitimate process on your own, they can go into court and demand that the government prove in court that that you have a right to hold them. That's what habeas is.
The administration at the time and their supporters were making the argument that these people were beyond any of these laws. In international legal settings, had we already established that this was not so, or do we have case law that what they were saying
mm-hmm. is that ordinarily the Geneva Conventions require some neutral tribunal to determine whether the person is someone who can be lawfully held. But the administration was saying, and that's called an Article 5 hearing,
okay.
But the administration was saying, yeah, but these guys aren't entitled to the Geneva Conventions, therefore we don't have to give them the benefit of this hearing. So that's one of the ways that they were trying to create a prison beyond the law.
Okay, so stopping there for a second. The public sphere doesn't immediately have the response to say, by what authority do you make this decision, though, right?
Well, this is one of the things that was very problematic on the part of the Bush administration. They
right.
just, President Bush concluded unilaterally that no laws protected these people who were held at Guantanamo, and as well as people who were held at black sites. No laws held them, no laws protect them from coercive interrogations or guaranteed humane treatment. The only guarantee they had was our promise to treat them well based on a unilateral commitment to, quote, be humane. But there was no law to which they were entitled. And then they got to define what humane was. And we saw what that led to. What that led to is the black sites and the redefinition of torture and all the things that we have seen throughout the Bush administration and that the Obama administration has been trying to correct. But that's the real paradigm shift, the idea of whether these people are entitled to any law at all.
To help us understand, this has been something I still never get a quite, and I guess it's probably because it's still in play, but I never get quite a tangible answer. Maybe you will be one of the first. What would be an example for a legitimate calling of a military commission? What are the legitimate grounds by which a person could wind up in a military commission, but not in a, say, a civil court?
A civilian court.
Civilian court, sorry, yes.
Well, I can tell you that there is theoretically a space for military commissions. There is such a thing as a violation of the laws of war for which a person could be prosecuted pursuant to military commissions. None of the cases that are currently contemplated, as far as I can tell, however, I mean, the second part of your question was, tell me an example of a crime that could not be prosecuted in a civilian court and could only be prosecuted in a military court. None of the cases that are currently described as candidates fit in that description.
Okay.
Everybody who's contemplated for prosecution, who's being held at Guantanamo now, could be prosecuted in an Article III, a regular civilian court. So the answer to your question is there are none.
That's interesting because there's such a strong case by a group of people who believe that military commissions can apply, but they too never offer me an example. It just seems to be a strong-held belief.
Yeah, it's a strong-held belief, but you asked a second piece of the question, which is, can you identify someone who cannot be prosecuted in a civilian court?
Right.
And the answer to that question is no. Or if there are, I suppose it's possible that there are some people who are innocent. Obviously, you could prosecute them, but you can't convict them of anything.
Right.
So, but presumably if they're innocent, you shouldn't be able to convict them in a military commission court either. And there might be some people that maybe you could have prosecuted them at one time, but the statute of limitations has run.
Mm-hmm.
So now the only thing that you could conceivably have prosecuted them for, it's too late. But that doesn't mean that it was not a candidate for civilian trials.
Right.
It doesn't mean that civilian trials were never available. It just means you held them too long, and now you've lost your opportunity.
Well, so for instance, like a case like the Cotter case, you know, if I understand the accusation, he lobbed a grenade at soldiers. I guess he had already been detained somehow, at least pulled aside, lobbed a grenade at soldiers, killing them, and that's his crime. I guess he was 14 at the time.
But I believe that's the allegation.
How, and that was in the theater of war at the time. That's in Afghanistan, correct? How in the world does that become a crime that he gets dragged back here and placed into this chasm of oblique law? By what law were they trying to try him under?
You mean in civilian court or in a military commission?
Either. We can create a charge, but you have to turn around and point to a statute at some point or a code and say that's what we're trying. That's the authority that grants me the right to hold.
That's right. You have to have some statutory foundation. And I don't know enough about the Cotter,
okay,
the specific Cotter allegations to say. I wouldn't want to speak out of school.
Sure.
There.
Sure.
Well, I shouldn't speculate.
Okay.
I don't want to go beyond my ken.
So I want to go, now we can head into the case that I have also been looking into, not at the level you have, so I'm glad you're here to help us get a little further. Abu Zubaydah was captured in Rawalpindi or Peshawar?
I think it was Faisalabad.
Faisalabad.
It was in Pakistan.
Okay, yeah. So he was captured in Pakistan after a raid that has now been very well publicized with John Kiriakou. At some point, in there, Ali Sufan becomes his first FBI interrogator, along with his Steve. I can't remember the other interrogator's name because he actually does very well in drifting into history behind Ali Sufan. But these two FBI agents are on the scene shortly after. Do you have an idea how soon after?
Of course, all I can tell you is the publicly available information.
That's
if it's not
fine.
In the public,
sure.
I can't tell you. But we believe that they arrived within days of his arrest.
Okay, so I know he had referred to him being in hospital condition still. The torture memos did not really come down until August 1st and afterwards. Do we have evidence in the public sphere of torture that happened beforehand?
There is significant reason to believe that at least some of the aggressive techniques began before the torture memo was written. It is not clear from the public record whether that includes waterboarding. I say that based on the public description in the ICRC report.
Correct.
As well as accounts of the way the program unfolded from the principal sources of information are the ICRC report, the Senate Armed Services Committee investigation, the CIA Inspector General report, and the DOJ Office of Professional Responsibility report. And collectively, there was also a moment when, if memory serves, John Ashcroft testified where he also thought it was conceivable that, based on the reconstruction, that the aggressive techniques may have begun before the OLC memo was drafted.
The case being presented about Abu Zubaydah is that he was number three in Al-Qaeda.
Well, they don't present that anymore. They
right.
did once, but they're not remotely saying that any longer.
On September 6, 2006, George Bush came out very proudly and boastfully, trying to basically... he had just lost. Had the Hamdan decision come down on that date, or was it within?
No, it had already come down.
It had just come down. So he was trying to now appeal to Congress to hurry up and give him the new Military Commissions Act, which they did. But he gets up in front of the audience and he basically boasts at what we've done in capturing a very important member, Abu Zubaydah, and he starts this narrative about who this person is. Let's talk about what the original case or the set of charges or allegations were, and then how they've walked that back.
Well, initially, they said some extraordinary, and you can still find it. You can still find it. Some people just repeat what's been said. Some of the media is not very careful. But he was the number three man in Al-Qaeda. I think they've now listed, I don't know, four or five different people who was the number three.
Right, right.
And he was the chief of operations, or he, you know, trained their counterinsurgency or counterintelligence. I mean, close associate of Osama bin Laden. I mean, it just all sorts of inflammatory stuff.
Are there any indications in the public record that you know of that would lead you to question the genuine nature of their belief in this? If I do convince myself that person A is really bad, everything I follow in behind that with that prejudiced mind will be according. But I am being genuine to the moment, at least, if I really believe that.
So there's two different questions. One is, okay, do they still believe that? The other is, did they believe it at the time?
Right.
I don't have any indication. I think the state of their intelligence when they arrested Abu Zubaydah in March of 2002 was so bad. I mean, so bad. They had so little sense of what was actually happening on the ground and such a very high level of fear that the combination of the belief that they could take no risks and bad intelligence genuinely led them to believe that what they were saying about him and thinking about him was true, or at least they were willing to overlook the signals that it was not true. I've never taken the position that they were venal in their initial confusion, that their initial confusion was malicious. It was wrong. I think everybody agrees with that now, and nobody in the United States government maintains anymore any of those things.
Okay.
They no longer say that he was a member of Al-Qaeda. They no longer say that he swore allegiance to Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden. They no longer say that he was an associate. They don't even say that he was ideologically aligned to him. In fact, they were ideologically opposed. They no longer say that the camp that he was allegedly associated with had anything to do with Al-Qaeda. They no longer say he had anything to do with 9/11 or with al-Qaeda members who participated in 9/11, they trained them or anything like that. They no longer say that he, what are some of the other things that they've retreated from, that he had any advanced knowledge of 9/11? No, they don't say anything like that. I mean, there's
so if you just start pulling all this away, the question then, before I even want it, I would love to get into those details, but then what do they have? What do they have left?
You know, I don't like to characterize the government's case for them. They can make their case for themselves, but the government's factual return in the habeas case is publicly available now. The government redacted a great deal of it.
Right.
I think it's not too far to say that they are holding him based on his alleged association with these guys, as he knew them. And beyond that, I would let the government answer questions.
We in past shows, we have covered a couple of the details, but in order to put him in historical context, I've read, I guess there's one CSRT for him publicly available. Is that correct? One?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have this one that I've read, and I was really fascinated with the dialogue because my understanding is that he ran Calden Camp. His focus was on training basically Islamic resistance to really anyone who would be a threat to these folks. He showed gratitude towards the U.S. intervention in Bosnia, said we did a good thing there. Is that correct?
Absolutely. He's always felt that way.
So in that case, we were the good guys. And his primary focus was really Chechnya, if you asked him for his personal opinion. He was more focused on Chechnya was what was in there. Is that correct?
I got to be very careful how you ask the question. Okay. I can only comment on what's in the public record. So if you ask me, what does my client think, I can't tell you. But if you ask me what's in the record...
In the public record.
Right. The public record relates that he has always taken the position that defense of Muslims who are under attack is an honorable thing. And that is consistent with what the U.S. view was in both Chechnya and Bosnia.
Okay. So that means...
Actually, it was consistent with the U.S. view in Afghanistan as well when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan.
So if I were to distill that down, then what that leaves us is that we, the United States, were not his focus. When he's doing what he's doing there, he's not even focused on us. He has no mind towards attacking us in any of his discussions.
Well, again, I can't tell you what his thinking is. But
in the CSRT discussions, there's nothing in what I read there.
Oh,
that's
absolutely clear in the CSRT.
No aim towards the U.S.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Then when he was asked about...
And in fact, I should say, the U.S. no longer alleges that he took any violent action against the United States.
Right. Okay. So then when asked about his relationship with al-Qaeda, he, in my impression, seemed to imply that bin Laden had come in with this universal jihad concept that was going to subsume the camp that he was running under the al-Qaeda control now, and he resisted that. That's correct, according to the CSRT?
That is correct. In fact, I think that's now a matter of public knowledge.
Okay.
I don't want to say that I agree with your characterization that he ran Calden, but what's a matter of public knowledge is that Calden was closed by the Taliban at bin Laden's direction in order to bring all camps under al-Qaeda in 2000.
I want to correct myself because actually there is better language for that. He was a coordinator of some sort to help bring people. That's what the CSRT alleges, and it seemed to be he accepted that he had coordination responsibilities.
I would say, again, I have to be very careful what's in the public record.
Sure.
The combination of what's in the CSRT and what's been reported in the press is he was described as a low-level travel agent.
Okay, I think that was fair characterization from what I read. Okay, so then that would basically mean that if bin Laden has come in kind of like a big Don, then they would be opposing forces in some way, at least. He was asking for permission for bin Laden to allow him to open the camp back up? That's the way it sort of reads it when I read
it. I don't remember whether that language is in the CSRT, but it's very clear that It was bin Laden who closed the Khaldun camp and refused to allow it to reopen.
Okay. One of the reasons he explained in there that I, when I talked to you yesterday, that I said really jumped out at me because I really enjoy language. And I've worked with international people long enough to watch idioms die at the end of my American lips, and or some idiom that they have. The president of the tribunal was saying that, well, Zubeda, throughout, without the interpreter, said that he was concerned a fight between bin Laden and the U.S. would end in a war race. Would that be a characterization that you read in his discussion, that he was concerned that a fight between these two was not in his interest?
It's absolutely clear that in the CSRT, Zubeda does not want there to be a war between Muslims in the West or Al-Qaeda in the West. He clearly does not want that to be there. Now, as you said, the interpretation, the meaning, it's just sort of lost in the translation, the meanings. And it's not clear that there was a meeting of the minds between, I was not there, I mean, there was no lawyer there, but between what Zubeda meant and what the director of the tribunal thought he was saying. It's not clear from the transcript at all whether they understood each other.
To be honest, I feel like I understand Zubeda's point of view in explaining the war race as opposed to a race war. I'm assuming that based on being an American, that the person who's the president of the tribunal is an American. And we have a word here or a phrase, you know, an idiom, race war, that means something completely different in light of those words. So let's look forward. The time keeps ticking by. We have this man in custody. He is black-sided. Sent to Thailand. Do we have in the public record other areas he was shipped to? What other countries he arrived in?
There is speculation about what some of the other countries were. There are people who say Morocco has been named, Poland, Romania, Afghanistan, there was supposedly a site. There may have been a black site at Guantanamo, but there's no official acknowledgement by the U.S.
Are there acknowledgments by other countries?
Not to my knowledge.
Not
well,
yet.
Wait,
okay.
Is that right? There may have been an acknowledgement by one of the Eastern European countries. I can't remember for sure.
He arrived in Guantanamo finally after, what was this, 2006? He was finally brought to Guantanamo?
September of 2006, that's right.
Okay, right about the same time that Bush finally got up on the microphone bully pulpit. Once he arrives in Guantanamo, do we have any information on additional abuse?
No.
No? It pretty much became very SOP at that point?
Oh, I didn't say that. I said we have no information.
Oh, so we had okay. That's a good answer. Okay, so we, you know, there's a lot of this man's cases now in the, you know, in the public sphere. He's used as a sort of a lightning rod in a way for the case and the, you know, the war on terror. They don't have charges. Have they filed any charges on him at this point, by the way?
No.
Is he still chargeless?
Absolutely no charges.
So we don't even know.
There never has been.
We can't, okay, this is, you know, this. How long do you imagine we hold people without even a single charge? What's the outside of this sphere? Is there any history of holding someone this long with zero charges?
Well, the only thing that's no, not in a context like this. I mean,
this is whole new cloth.
This is all new. The only thing that's remotely similar. I mean, there are such things as, you know, sex offender registration commitments,
right.
So that you can hold people who are sex offenders and can't control themselves. They just have this irresistible impulse to commit sex offenses. That's the only other thing that's like, and obviously is that not like this at all.
And even that just got a recent ruling.
Yeah, but there's nothing else like this in U.S. law, no.
So then where do we go from here?
We have a very bad situation on our hands.
Okay.
My fear is what the administration, with the involvement of Congress, will do is create a preventive detention statute that says we can hold people as long as the government proves in some classified setting that the guy, regardless of what he's done or may not have done or we think did in the past, the past is irrelevant. We think he will be bad in the future, and we can hold him based on that prediction. And if they do that, that will be the first of its kind in the world, or the first of its the first of its kind in U.S. history. And that would be a very, very bad thing for U.S. law, and not just law, but U.S. society, because we will only use that statute for Muslims. It will be a category that is peopled only by Muslims.
And at this point, Muslims only.
Right, and it will be contribute to and intensify and solidify and institutionalize the demonization that has begun and has been so vitriolic since 9/11. It's a very worrisome development. To me, it's the most dangerous thing that is happening in American society.
Well, that's one of the reasons why we're talking about it.
I'm sorry?
I said that's one of the main reasons why we're talking about it, is that it's kind of hard to...
Well, the regrettable thing is that people are no longer talking about it, and there is this sense that Obama that we have closed that dark chapter with the election of President Obama, and that's really regrettable. If you look at the polling data, and I realize polls can be problematic, but
sure.
the evidence of increased tolerance for most racial groups and most groups that have always been described historically as marginalized, like gays and lesbians, and much more acceptance throughout most strata of society.
Right.
And the one exception to that, I mean, you know, there's very little overt discrimination against Catholics anymore and Jews. It's the sort of thing that has really fallen by the wayside. And the one exception to that is the open, acknowledged, widespread demonization of Muslims, of Islam. And it's really now quite widespread at a level that hasn't existed in this country any time in the last century. It's really remarkable and, to me, very worrisome, very, very worrisome.
Yeah, if we create a special category of people who simply just aren't up to snuff, then we can do just about anything. Today, it could be someone named Abu Zubaydah. Tomorrow, it could be someone named Gomez.
Yeah. You know, there's that. There's that old saying that, you know, first they came for the gypsies, and I wasn't a gypsy, and so on. While I think that that's true, that's not. I don't care. I don't worry because I fear that next time they'll come for the Jews. I don't have to have, I am Jewish. I don't have to have any fear that it's going to reach me in order to think that it's wrong. It's wrong even if it doesn't reach anybody else at all. It doesn't have to reach anybody named Samson. It doesn't have to reach anybody named Margulies. The fact that it reaches someone named Ahmed is sufficient.
Right.
And that's what motivates me.
That's one of the important things to understand about this. What about if someone later could refer to these for precedent? If they said, you know, well, we can do this now because look back here, this was approved and no one ever called that out. And you have a whole bunch of speechwriters, for instance, for Bush that like to refer to the, you know, but look what Lincoln did this and, you know, and FDR did this. And to them, these are good things. These were presidential powers. Mark Thiessen, for instance, is one of the little apparatchiks who likes to do things like that. So they are citing bad examples in law as good examples. They're flipping
right.
them on air.
Yeah, I mean, but you're always going to have that. I mean, no one should have any illusions. This is people who are inclined to justify bad things will always seize on what they're able to find in order to achieve that. And there's no mystery there.
If you look at the OLC and OPR reports, what is your thought on the fact that a single senior attorney in the DOJ can decide that all the work in the report that I read, which was done by many different officials, I believe, he can just decide, nah.
Well, I have to say, I mean, on this one, I actually agree with the eventual OPR report. I don't think their conduct was sanctionable. I don't think they should have been disbarred. I think that they showed colossally bad judgment. I am a very, very careful student of the moment when they were making these decisions. I mean, I for another book I'm writing, have been immersing myself in the immediate post 9/11 mind frame, and rereading everything I can get my hands on. And it is impossible to reconstruct the moment of fear that this country felt. I mean, I was just reading a transcript just yesterday of an old McLaughlin report, you know, that TV show.
Sure.
Where they were
watching every Friday night.
Right. They were very seriously discussing, I think this was early November of 2001, the likelihood that someone in Al-Qaeda, and they just assumed it was bin Laden, had a suitcase nuke. That is, there was this story that there were 25 nuclear devices that you could carry in a suitcase that the former Soviet Union had lost, and they were out there on the black market, and there was, you may not remember the story, but it was an extremely widespread story, and it was just very seriously understood that, A, that they're out there, and B, they're probably in the hands of a rich financier,
right,
who is sympathetic to bin Laden, or maybe even in bin Laden's hand. Well, you know, the level of fear and the way that drove policymaking,
sure,
it was wrong. It was morally bankrupt. It led them to make terrible mistakes. But it was not, in my estimation, venal. It was not, in my estimation, criminal. And I have said this publicly, and I've said it in writing, I do not think any of these guys should be indicted, and I don't think anybody should be disbarred. Now, I know that on the left, I'm alone in that view, but that's my view.
So if I said that I think Dick Cheney should be tried for war crimes for authorizing these things, you would say, well, you know, look, putting him in, looking at the mindset at the time, that might not be so easy to pull off?
Not that it wouldn't be easy to pull off. I think you could do it. But, I mean, I think the crimes were committed.
Okay.
But because motive is not really relevant to whether a crime was committed.
Okay.
Some people who are friends of mine will say, Joe, what you're saying goes to sentencing. It goes to how culpable they are, not to whether they're guilty. And that's technically true. I think that crimes were committed. But I think it's a terrible idea for the United States government and for society to prosecute people. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that we should do nothing, which apparently
right.
is the choice of the Obama administration. I think that we should have a thorough airing of exactly what took place
right.
on exactly what authorization by exactly what actors. Because it's only if you have a complete airing with no intention to punish anyone for it, just an intention to understand it, that's the only way you can learn from it. As soon as you make it into a punitive act, you're
adding to it, right?
Yeah, you add to it, you increase the polarization. Now, I recognize there are very, very strong arguments on all sides.
Sure.
But and there's no perfect solution. But I come down strongly against punishment. In addition, the punishment is directed at individual actors as though the problem were simply individual actors who did bad things. And it ignores systemic and institutional responses that the United States always makes during moments of perceived threat, not just during times of war. People always want to think that it's just a time of war thing, and they talk about Lincoln and FDR and so on. That's ridiculous. This is a very common, familiar reaction on the part of the government and the American public, not just government, when there are moments of perceived threat. And that threat can be from 1,000 different things. Just think about the vitriol about the anti-immigration debate.
Right.
Arizona doesn't feel like they're, you know, at war with illegal aliens or undocumented people who come into the country. But, you know, their response is very much that in that same thing.
And the same genre of being afraid.
Of course,
crime out the roof, even though the numbers really don't back that up.
It's all the usual tropes about, you know, that trace back to an authoritarian personality, an ethnocentric view of the world. And
right.
It's not limited to war.
Well, looking at the fact that there are some proceedings happening against, for instance, Donald Rumsfeld in Germany, We had the officers and the 23 officers in Italy who were basically found guilty in absentia. We have international obligations to investigate as well. What do you think reasonably should happen in that sphere? Same thing, basically a public hearing of the information.
Absolutely.
And go from there?
Absolutely. Metaphorically, I would lay it all out on a massive national table.
Okay.
And let everybody in the country comb through it, come to their own conclusions. And I realize that everybody will put their own spin on it. And
sure.
Most people will not take the time to comb through it. They'll simply, listen to what Sean Hannity says or Keith Olbermann says. And that will be enough for them.
Or they might even listen to what I say.
They certainly won't listen to what I say.
All right.
But you know, that I think is much healthier for democracy than singling out someone to be prosecuted, or singling out half a dozen people to be prosecuted.
And are there areas of power grabs in the last 8 years that you, if you could reset them right now, you would take away from the Obama administration?
Oh, the fundamental perspective is not a power grab. It's this idea that the problem of transnational terror is one that requires an alternative legal system, and that our existing or then existing legal institutions are not up to the task.
Okay.
The idea that you need to create a third system dovetails nicely with the idea that these, quote, these people are beyond the reach of structures created for, you know, the problems, the prosaic problems of a civilized nation. I mean, it contributes to and furthers the demonization. So fundamentally, what I would want, if I could reset the clock, was for people to think it's a terrible thing when crime happens, and when a person commits a crime, we will prosecute them as a human being, unconnected to, the same way if I commit a crime, it's not an indictment of Jews. And if an African-American commits a crime, it ought not be, although it sometimes is, perceived as an indictment of all African-Americans. And when a Christian fundamentalist flies a plane into a building in Austin, it's not an indictment of all Christians. It reflects something more about that individual than anything else. That's
right.
What I would like to see us go back to.
In the first interview for our shows, Colonel Morris Davis and I addressed that when he had brought up the idea that really the modern issues do not very well settle into Geneva Court discussions because we're dealing with non-state players or transnational players. And he said we need to create something that's more like an international terrorism court, but that also, for instance, could deal with piracy, like the Somali pirates, who are also engaged in international or transnational actions. Is that the same thing?
No. It may be that you need some international court to deal with something called terrorism. But I think it's probably true that the laws of war need to be modified, to be tinkered with somewhat, to because of the problem of transnational terror. But, you know, we modify the laws of war all the time as
sure.
The demands change. It may also be true at some level that criminal procedure, the laws of crime, need to be modified somewhat. But those are tinkering with existing systems rather than creating a whole new system. So the idea of preventive detention, the idea of a national security court, the idea of Guantanamo, stuff like that, those are whole new systems.
Right.
That's what we don't need.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about.
Well, I want to thank you for your input on this today. I want to stay in touch about these cases because we're not over yet. We have a long way to go. And the government keeps changing its tune as new information becomes very public. One final question will be about the difference between covering information, your thought on the information that comes out, and the difference between state secrets and that are legitimate and state secrets that are embarrassing.
Well,
and closing thought on
there is
on
such a thing, and I think there ought to be such a thing as a state secrets doctrine. But I think it's grossly overused, and it has always been overused as a shield to prevent the disclosure of that which would be considered embarrassing. And the reason you need robust judicial involvement is to guard against that. And regrettably, the Obama administration has been more or less where the Bush administration was on the state secrets doctrine. And the fear is that they, too, are using it to prevent the disclosure of that which is embarrassing either to them or to previous officials. And that's the wrong reason for it. That's how democracy dies.
Indeed. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Joe, and you have a good weekend. I hope you come back.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.